Yeah. Yeah. Was that Leonard Cohen? Yeah. So, and you were a backup singer for Leonard Cohen and a close friend of his. Yes. Yeah. So you sing a lot of his music. Yeah. Wonderful. And then also I wanted to let you know that, you know, we call our house band Chris Kimbler and the Cats. Well, we had Chris Kimbler and a cat today. One of our cats is back. Yeah. Dave and Chris did a fantastic job of playing, and we invited Rex and John, but they were occupied elsewhere, but they're both fine. So someday, as we start to reinvent this church, and as we start to come back together, we will be reunited, for a while at least. I think some of you know that John is moving to Colorado. Yeah, that's wrong. We're not happy about that, but he's happy about it, so I guess we have to be mature about it, don't we, right? Yeah. So in that line of spiritual maturity, the name of the talk today is So, You Want to Be a Mystic? I'm assuming that many of us do. You know, we call this the flat choir up here, or the mystics, and I'd say pretty much all of them are mystics. I don't know about Spartacus. You know, I don't know. I don't want to go through the list and say who's a mystic and who's not, because the truth is that we're all mystics, but we're not there yet in the trajectory of this talk. My assumption is that we all want to have that mystical consciousness. We all want that consciousness of connection to the divine. So with that in mind, I'm going to start with a story. And this is a story from the Sufi tradition, Nasruddin, who is the holy fool. Many of you know that in wisdom traditions, the fool is often the purveyor of great wisdom. Happens in Shakespeare too. It happens in this church, believe it or not. The fool has great wisdom sometimes. Anyway, so Nasruddin is on a boat with three professors. And the first professor says to him, Nasruddin, have you studied astronomy? And Nasruddin says, no, I haven't gotten around to that. The professor says, well, you have ruined your life because without astronomy, you don't know how to steer the boat. Nasruddin said, okay, point taken. Then the second professor comes on board and he says, Nasruddin, they all talk like this, by the way. That's my universal language for snob. Nasruddin, have you studied meteorology? And Nasruddin says, you know, I have not gotten around to that either. And so the meteorologist says, well, you have ruined your life because with meteorology, you can know the way the winds blow and the way the currents go, and your boat can move forward in the sea. Nasruddin said, okay, all right, point taken. Third professor comes up and he says, Nasruddin, have you studied oceanography? And Nasruddin says, guess what? I haven't gotten around to that one either. And the professor says, well, you've ruined your life because with oceanography, you can know where the coral shoals are, and you can navigate the sea for where to find food, and your life is just ruined without this information. Nasruddin goes, okay, point taken. So they travel along for another hour or two, and then Nasruddin comes back on deck, and he talks to the three professors, and he says, gentlemen, have you studied swimming? And the men say, no, that's way too trivial. That's way too trivial for us. And Nasruddin says, well, you've ruined your life because the boat is sinking. Sure you saw that one coming, right? Yeah. So what's the point of this in a talk about mysticism? Well, really, you know, I think that great spiritual teaching, and I believe that we have great spiritual teaching in this church, and it's not about me, it's about all of us and how we co-create this message together. Great spiritual teaching goes to the main point first. It's like when Jesus said, seek ye first the kingdom of God. Seek ye first the kingdom of God, then all these things shall be added unto you. The point, the meaning, the greatest message ever told is about our oneness with God. And in light of that oneness, in light of that main thing, all of the other ologies and ographies, and I was going to say ectomies, but that's more medical, and, you know, self-help strategies and all of the things that we learn are secondary to that seeking first our oneness with God. That's what Ernest Holmes knew. He, in the way that we pray here, you hear the practitioners do it all the time, is that we talk about the nature of God first, the nature of the universe or the nature of love, whatever it is you want to call it. You don't have to call it God. God doesn't care. they talk about the nature of God first, and then they talk about our connection to it because we really are one with that. So with that being in mind, I am assuming, again, that everybody here wants that, wants to be a mystic. Everybody listening wants to have that mystical consciousness, that unitive consciousness that knows that we are one with God. Really, I want to say a little bit more, though, about what is a mystic. What is a mystic? Well, the short answer is affirmed every Sunday when we sing, "I am remembering who I am." A mystic is the I am presence. Mystical teachers like Rupert Spira, Held Waskin, Peter Russell, others that I've listened to over the last several months, you know, they talk about how I is that which is self-knowing. Every sentient being has a sense of I. And it's not the big, it's not the small I of the ego, it's this I-ness that knows, that can experience the world around it. It is the infinite subject that split itself into many, an infinite number of objects, and the I am perceives that numerous plethora of objects. It is also awareness, it is consciousness, it is that which experiences. Just to get a sense of what the I am presence is for each of us, and it's all, there is this consistency around the I am presence for all of us, even though there's multiplicity here. But think about, let's give you four different things to think about. Think about a vegetable garden. Think about your first car. Perceive and remember what it feels like to be joyful. Think about your first grade teacher. You see how diverse all of those experiences are, but something in you experienced all of them. The experiencer remains the same. You may have a different experience, but that which experiences is constant. It's like the permanence that is in back of all impermanence. All of the things that I listed are objects. They will all fade away. They are finite. But the experiencer, that which experiences, which is awareness, which is the true self, which is the I am presence, that which is aware, that is infinite. In an interview that I listened to with Brother Rupert Spira, who's a mystical teacher, he's there sitting next to Mr. Rogers up in the balcony, in case you want to know who he is. the person interviewing him asked him, what are the qualities of the I am presence? And he said that the I am is present, omnipresent, meaning everywhere, meaning that it has to be within us too, because we are part of presence. It is omnipresent. It is inherently peaceful. It is unlimited. And it is unconditionally fulfilled. Get that? Present, peaceful, unlimited, fulfilled, all without conditions. That's why Emerson wrote that only the finite has wrought and struggled, but the infinite lies stretched in smiling repose. The infinite does not react to conditions. The infinite is aware of what is happening, but it is aware yet unaffected. And it is in that place of choice that Hugh mentioned in the reading. So that's the I am presence. That's the I am presence, and we are all that. Except when we're not. The truth is that we are always the I am presence, but sometimes we don't act like it. So, as you know, the church has been closed for about a year. This is the most people we've had in the church since probably March 15th or so of 2020. And we have a whopping, 40, 50 people here today? Woohoo! It's actually really fun to see all of you. I'm very grateful to see you, and we look forward to expanding that as the days are coming on. But you know, we're in the process of working with the state and the government and making plans to reopen. And for the last two Sundays, I had guest speakers, and my plan was to be really, really connected to God, to mystical awareness, to meditate deeply every day, to read wise and spiritual texts, just to give me that infusion of consciousness that I felt like would be really really helpful in terms of making plans for reinventing the church and reopening the church and knowing exactly what to do. That was my plan, to connect to the mystic within me for 2 solid weeks. Have you ever seen the Ten Commandments when... when the Hebrew people make the golden calf? That's God smiting me. The Hebrew people make the golden calf, and they're all like, I watched it this morning. It's pretty cool. It's like, you know, 30 years ago, I would have wanted to be at that party, because they're all running around, big sweaty men and scantily clad women, and they're all having a good time throwing things at each other and drinking and carousing and carrying on and dancing and bowing down to this golden calf. They took all of their gold from Egypt and they melted it down and they made this material thing to worship. Okay, that was my consciousness this past 2 weeks when I was planning. Really planning. It was on my to-do list. I put it on a spreadsheet. I was planning to connect to mystical consciousness daily and devoutly. God laughs. I heard that. Yeah, I hear God laughing right now in the presence of all of you. Thank you. Yeah. So... you know, and what I noticed from that, see, one of the things is when we go to that place is that we don't really have to punish ourselves. It's really just about information, you know. And it would have probably been nice to have meditated more and to have done a little more research and whatnot. But, you know, I'll get to that. But what I did learn was as valuable. And it's not something that I haven't met before, and perhaps it's familiar to all of you. Have you ever noticed that we are often called to make a choice between lasting happiness and instant gratification? Instant gratification looks really good much of the time. So much of the time in this 2-week mental bacchanal I was having, I was going for the instant gratification. And then one of the other things I learned, it's funny, I learned this from a really odd source. You know, I was not doing my spiritual reading like I wanted to, but I was reading all kinds of other stuff. And one of the things too, you know, when you start really embodying God and longing for God, and you just see God everywhere, which makes complete sense given the theology that we teach here. But I was reading an article about Law and Order SVU. And why do people watch it? And why do people find it comforting? Now, if you've never seen that show, in the intro, there's a little preamble that they do. I can actually do it from memory because I've seen it a lot. But I won't do the whole thing. But basically, they talk about heinous crimes. And vicious felonies are administered to by a team of dedicated detectives. So we're talking about a show that's about heinous crimes and vicious felonies, and people watch it for comfort. But you know what? When I read the article, I got it. I mean, I know that I watch it because I like wounded healers, and there's a lot of, you know, the nobility of the detectives in the show is just beautiful and striking, and they're all sort of messed up like me. You know, they're wounded healers, and I like that part. But the thing that the article said is that people watch it because it's familiar. There's a formula. And you can spot the formula. You know, if you've seen it a lot, you know that guy didn't do it. He's showing up too soon in the plot here. There's a formula, and you know we have these hidden formulas in ourselves all of the time. Whether it's worrying is going to help make this better, criticizing this person will change them. We have these formulas, and they are familiar, and so we stick to them at the expense of casting ourselves into the void of unknowing and infinite impermanence and infinite possibility. Remember, unlimited. Unlimited means that we can't hold it in a tight little box. We can't put like a little crime scene, you know, diagram around it. We cast ourselves into that unknown, or we avoid casting ourselves into that unknown for the sake of what is familiar. And I read that and I had a lot of compassion for this morning when I was watching the scene from Ten Commandments, worshiping the golden calves. Oh, they're from Egypt. That's what they did there. They know that. You know, it's connecting to matter, tangible matter over invisible spirit. How many times have we done that? It just exhausts me to think about how many times I take what is happening here in my face that is tangible, that I can see, that I can smell, and that seems so real, when really there is this huge other reality of infinite possibility, unconditional fulfillment, inherent peace, and unlimited nature that is always, always present. Our attachment to what is familiar, our attachment to instant gratification, our attachment to matter, manifests in many ways. It manifests in some of the thoughts that I talked about, trying to control, trying to judge, worrying, all of those things. It also manifests in physical behavior. And what Hugh said in the reading is that, you know, it's like there are some wild beasts running around in us that we can tame, but we tame them gently. You know, I think about the wild beasts running around in my house. Maybe that's the reason I have so many animals, is because I learn so much from them. You know, we have this, many of you know that we have this 20-pound rabbit who goes by many names. Her name is Hip Hop, but I call her Ipso Fatso, and Hip Hopotamus, because she's huge. And, you know, I have seen her trample our guinea pig to get a blueberry. When we have them in, like if there's a little drizzle, we bring them into the house, which is disgusting, but we bring them in the house anyway, and she'll lie on the living room floor like Jabba the Hutt with her food bowl right there, and she'll just lean her head over and eat from the food bowl. She totally is like a slug, like Jabba the Hutt. She just oozes all over the floor like this rolls of fat. And, you know, I see myself in that. You know, I haven't trampled Hugh recently to get to the remote first to watch a murder show, you know. But I see that attachment to what I want when I want it, because it's instantly gratifying, and it feels familiar, and it feels like it's safety and it's matter, and I can touch it and I can sense it. And if I'm touching and sensing and smelling and eating this thing, I don't have to be in that void of unknowing and the uncertainty, which is so powerful. But getting over that threshold into the place where it actually feels powerful is challenging sometimes. So how do we navigate the willingness to be in the void and getting over that threshold to the place where we start to see that the void really is infinite possibility, and that the void is for us, that which we cannot see immediately, that which we cannot hear immediately, that which we cannot smell immediately, that which we cannot touch immediately, that is all for us. I was listening to this interview that I was telling you about before, and one of the guys who was being interviewed said that something that you can do is just talk in the voice of the higher self. You know, we've done that in this church. I remember when Patrick Harbula taught here, he would have us speak as our expanded self in the third person. This guy was recommending that we speak to ourselves. If, you know, we notice ourselves worrying, we go, oh, okay then, I see you're worrying. And that's speaking from the place of the kind observer. It's not, stop that worrying. That's not the kind observer. It's, oh, look, aren't you cute? You're worrying. Wow. You're just worrying again. You know, that's what you do. But maybe make another choice, like the reading said. Could you choose something else? Could you choose to worry just a little less? You know, it's witnessing and befriending, something else that we talk about a lot here. It's not witnessing to punish, but it's witnessing to befriend. So, you know, you can make up your own mantra, whatever you want to do. It's just becoming conscious and observing what we're thinking and what we're realizing, and recognizing, again, as the reading said, that we actually do have a choice about what we're thinking. Our thoughts do not have us. We have our thoughts. And they're not even really ours. They're just in the sea of consciousness, and we pick the ones that will make us feel the worst, basically, or the ones that will lead to instant gratification versus long-lasting happiness. And we pick them because we're familiar. We're not doing anything that any other human hasn't done before. We're all just doing time. We're all just doing the best we can. But we can rise above that just simply by cultivating that kind observer, that witnessing and befriending practice, and just say, oh, look, there you are again. If that doesn't work for you, do something else. I think one of the mantras that they suggested was there it goes. So I'm like, there she goes, there she goes again, everybody. Da 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 da. I don't know the words. Okay. The other one is another song. It's remember that song, that rap song that goes, whoop, there it is, whoop, there it is. So you're worrying and you go, whoop, there it is. A little distracting because, you know, you have to do this when you when you say it. It's challenging in the grocery store or whatever. But anyway, see, that's the point. It's recognizing that we all do this all the time. You are not doing something evil. You are not doing something wrong. You're not wicked if you're having these kinds of thoughts. You just observe them. You have a sense of humor about them. You just be with them and allow them to be. You know, when I was thinking about this past week of all these grandiose plans that I made about connecting with God and meditating for hours and listening to Sanatam Kaur, the Sikh chants, and to read these lofty texts and listen to podcasts and to listen to Gaia Network instead of Netflix, Law and Order, Criminal Minds, and all of those things. I had all these big plans, and then, you know, not doing it, I just was saying to myself, dang, you are wicked. You are wicked. You know, you don't hear wicked in religious science churches very much, do you? I can guarantee that I'm probably the only science of my minister. Not the only minister. There are other denominations, perhaps, that say wicked frequently, but that is talking about wicked. And, you know, because it's funny. It's funny to think that we're wicked. I tried to look up in the Bible, like, I Googled, what are the really funny quotes about wickedness in the Bible? Didn't come up with much. The ones that I saw were probably not ones that I could share with people because a lot of people here have had traumatic religious pasts and I don't want to trigger anybody, but I thought they were freaking hilarious. You know, they're putting this image of God on God that makes it look like God sometimes will get out of the wrong side of the bed in the morning and just start smiting and smacking, and it's like a wrestling. You know, what's that wrestling called? Worldwide Wrestling? Glorious Ladies of Wrestling? GLOW? It's like that. You know, and when I know what I've studied and I know this stuff about unitive consciousness, when we know this stuff about unitive consciousness, we can just say, oh, they didn't mean that. They didn't mean that about the smiting. They didn't mean that about the wickedness. What wickedness is in the Bible, what wickedness is to me, is when we have forgotten who we are, when we are reconnecting to something that gives us immediate comfort, and we have simply forgotten something that's going to make us feel good in the moment. We have simply forgotten that the real source is learning how to swim in the consciousness of the divine. That is the real deal, and that is mystical consciousness. The good news about all of that is that if you are here, and I don't even mean here, I mean here on the planet Earth, you already are a mystic in the making. You may not know how much of a mystic you are, but it's just a matter of realizing it. Because if a mystical consciousness, I am, if it is the I am presence, the I am is omnipresent. It is peaceful. It is inherently fulfilled. It is divine, and it is everywhere, and it is in you. I'm going to close by this quote by David Stendhal Rast, who is a Catholic monk, and he wrote, "We are all meant to be mystics. We do a great disservice by putting mystics up on a pedestal and thinking of them as a special kind of human being. The truth is that every human being is a special kind of mystic, and that creates a tremendous challenge for each one of us to become precisely the mystic that we were meant to be." What kind of mystic are you meant to be? I enjoy and anticipate and am eager to support that in you as we start reinventing the church, as we start reopening, as we start coming together on a more regular basis, as we start learning from what this past year has been, as we know that the uses of adversity are sweet and that these things are not against us, that they are counselors that feelingly remind us what we are. I am eager to know what kind of a mystic each of us will become, and even more than that, what kind of a mystical center we will be together. Let's start exploring that now, and let us pray.